Hey, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend, Rick, and today we have Jesse Tinsley, who's the founder and CEO of Job Mobs. Job Mobs is a recruitment process outsourcing firm, and unlike a recruiting agency, the recruiters work in-house at the company. You might be talking to someone that works for an RPO firm and not know it. So we're going to ask Jesse to kind of explain the process. Before starting Job Mobs, Jesse was a recruiter at 23andMe, Nowdo, and Coinbase. He's also advised startups like Consensus, HackerRank, Protocol Labs, Stellar Development Foundation, and more. So, I mean, there's obviously a very clear trend line in terms of his work portfolio, his client list, kind of the cutting edge, the bleeding edge of tech. There's some Web3, there's some crypto, there's some biohealth and health tech. There's some hard sciences in there as well. So thanks for coming on the show, Jesse.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Excited to be here.
Hey, Jesse, so what made you decide to quit college? Were you about 20, 21 and said, hey, I'm gonna start a recruiting firm?
Yeah, it's a good question. I started, so the backstory to that is I actually started sourcing when I was 15 years old. I grew up in Silicon Valley, was always fairly entrepreneur. Both my parents were entrepreneurs. My dad ran a construction company. My mother was a recruiting consultant for a lot of years. So growing up, I did two things for money. I would work construction, which I didn't like as much. That was very hard compared to sourcing. So I did a lot of sourcing for allowance, basically. So I learned recruiting at a pretty young age. And then during the 08 recession, I was forced to drop out of college, and I applied to a bunch of like the Aerotech, Allegis, Kelly type companies, but none of them were hiring like entry-level recruiters, right? As you might imagine. And so the only option I really had was to start a recruiting firm that did contingent placements at the time. And I was about 22 when I actually launched. And so it's been quite the ride since then, but was a lot of alignment of unfortunate circumstances at the time that led me to where we are today. So
that's interesting. All right, I don't mean to get too personal. So was your dad like, wait, come on, get a hammer, do some construction work. did he try to push you into that, or no, that wasn't?
No, he was not. He's pretty cool about all of that. He didn't necessarily want his kids to do construction. So it wasn't,
right.
Wasn't and you're, forced so you, on us, thankfully.
Not and your mom did recruiting, that. So she was like, all right, hey, this is cool. You'll be in a nice, comfortable office with the air conditioner on in the summer. It's all, very comfy. Yeah. Maybe that's a better route than being outside in the hot weather, doing construction work.
For sure. And I think my first taste of Silicon Valley too is one of our first customers early on was 23andMe, and I showed up there, and 23andMe at the time, Anne was married to Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google. And so it was mini Google at 23andMe. There were 30 people, and it was just Google's campus, but packed into this small office off Shoreline Boulevard. And it was pretty eye-opening for being a 23-year-old going into your first tech office. It was pretty fun, especially that one in particular. So
Can you walk us through the early stages of that entrepreneurial spirit? I mean, as early as 15, sourcing, when did it finally click that, it can come from a side gig or a passion project to actually hey, I actually can do this full time and run a business there?
It took a while. I think, there's a few things. I was working, even when I was starting the company, because I didn't have any money, I was pretty broke at 22, like most, I think 22-year-olds are. And I worked as a firefighter on the weekends. So I worked for Cal Fire, which is a lot of fun. So that's my backstory there. I basically bootstrapped it through having another full-time job. And I did that for a couple of years. And then things kind of took off around like 2015. And that's 2015 is kind of when the big shift happened, and I went all in towards the end of that year, early 2016. So,
you know, your passion is tech, and I know you do other verticals as well, but let's say within the tech sector, what are you seeing now? Like, it seems like the layoffs have subsided a little bit. And from your postings, it looks like you're kind of net positive that things are turning around for the better. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think definitely trending that way. So I think, like, if you look at tech the last, since call it like the end of Q1 2022, you saw then was like a massive ramp up, right? Basically, like, no layoffs for the previous 2 years of that time frame going back to COVID. And then you see a ramp up of layoffs spiking probably middle of this year, May or June, roughly. I think there's a cool chart I posted. We could share that infographic, but it was posted. I shared that maybe 2 weeks ago, but it showed like the spike in layoffs basically peaking middle of this year, earlier this year, and then starting to taper off. And that's kind of what we're seeing in the jobs related market. So I don't think the jobs are going to come roaring back like they did in 21, but I do think we're starting to see an uptrend in jobs and less layoffs, right? So it might not be like crazy compared to what it was the last 10 years, but it's definitely trending in the right direction in terms of a lot of jobs opening in Q4 and in Q1 next year. That won't fill some of like the void that there is for certain jobs, but other jobs like engineering are going to go right back to where they were pretty quickly. So.
Yeah, speaking of that, so what are some of the areas that you see that are relatively hot? Let's say you start with the tech sector. You know, is it the software engineers because they're always hot, or are there other product managers? What's, you know, for the people watching this who are not sure, hey, where do I stand? Are there jobs, not jobs? Like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, it's a good question. Engineers are always in demand, probably the most like pretty high scarcity qualified folks, but we're seeing an uptrend like in terms of like sectors. AI is obviously taking off, tons of funding going into that space this year. That's probably like our number one segment. If you're looking for jobs and listening, Unlearn AI, Baton AI, like all doing like cool ton of stuff that they're hiring a lot of engineers and data scientists. And then from there, it's like some, you probably see like product managers and then a mix of like go-to-market functions starting to ramp back up, like marketing and sales, business development, business operations, business strategy. Beyond that, like sectors wise, we're seeing a lot of hiring in the SaaS space. So like enterprise SaaS companies seem to be doing really well. So if you're looking at like sectors to apply to, that's probably how I'd stack rank it. If you have a little bit of experience in any of these industries, is like AI, enterprise SaaS. You can see this like based on like the latest earnings reports too, like Samsara and HubSpot and all these types of enterprise SaaS companies are actually doing really, really well financially. And they're all ramping up hiring, it seems. From there, it probably breaks down to more like Web3 is actually starting to trend back up. So they haven't been hiring for like the last year and a half either. And that seems to be picking up as well. So it seems like tech overall is starting to recover. It's just going to be a little bit slower than it has historically.
How is the compensation? Is it ticking downwards a little bit from where it was?
Yeah, this is probably my most unpopular opinion of a lot of this. So basically with like, not so much for engineers, but for a lot of other, pretty much most other jobs, maybe excluding engineering and sales, those compensations trending down in the US specifically and trending up elsewhere, which is great for folks in other countries. But basically like globalization is taking over pretty heavy. In fact, a lot of the growth we're seeing in Q4 isn't US-based jobs. We're looking at Europe, APAC, and LATAM. It's like probably 75% of the job openings we're seeing. So you're seeing a lot of like nearshoring, offshoring, and globalization of workforces, which is great for those folks working in those regions. And then you're also seeing like AI and automation replace and impact jobs. So it's like a combination of all of that plus high interest rate environment. Basically, creating a scenario where like there's pretty downward, like high downward pressure on income, unfortunately. That doesn't mean that like if you have really niche skill sets, like you're still going to get a really, really good job offer in the US. It just means that overall, like the macro trends are pointing and forcing wages down pretty heavily.
Is there a big arbitrage between, let's say, someone in Silicon Valley compared to Eastern Europe? Or is it sort of even out because they're just, they have as much knowledge as a US person?
There is some amazing talent. Like I think actually, like just to give this is my personal opinion, like on remote work, I think there's talented people all over the world, across any, there's no like gap in terms of skill set, right? There might be a gap in like experience and like connections, but overall, like the skill sets of an engineer, I think in the US versus Eastern Europe are pretty comparable, I think, on an average spectrum. But I think the difference is a lot of companies are trying to save money right now. So like the cost of a US engineer versus one that's in Eastern Europe or Latin America or APAC regions can be significantly less, right? You're looking at paying maybe half or, you know, a third in some cases of the overall cost.
Rick, no, do you notice, does that track kind of what you see on the Blind platform?
Yes, indeed. I mean, we're seeing some large publicly listed companies, Lyft, Intuit, those types that are hiring abroad, right? And so they have development, so-called development centers, or they are, a common trend is there are some startups that are even getting into this where they're hiring developers that are in Latin America, South America, because there's a great level of cultural and like language, English language, American culture fluency, as well as the hard skills and engineering. And the time zone difference is pretty much the same, if not maybe just 1 or 2 hours ahead. And so you're able to kind of really get the most out of your dollar there. Where we're seeing companies that are hiring in Poland, India, the UK even, some that are using Canada as a North America base because of the ongoing immigration issues in the US, right? Some of their employees, they can't get their H-1B visa in the lottery, or some, you know, folks that are abroad that aren't even going to bother trying to figure out the U.S. immigration and stand in that line when they can just get that permanent residency in Canada much sooner.
Yeah. Did they just do this recently where you could just, I don't want to say cut in front of the line, but if you're a tech person with certain skill sets, welcome, come right in, right?
Canada did, yes. Where they specifically targeted folks that are in the U.S. or had an interest in the U.S., mm-hmm. where basically if you had an H-1B visa, you know, for some of these folks, depending on your country of origin, the line for getting that H-1B visa to getting your kind of permanent residency card, your green card status can be years, even a decade or longer. And so Canada said, hey, you know, if you have this H-1B visa, come to Canada and you'll get that permanent residency in 2 years, maybe 3 years. And that program actually filled up on the first day. Tens of thousands of people raised wow. their hands and took them up and said, you know what, I'm willing to go to Team Canada. And wow. so we're seeing that a lot in spades in the tech industry.
Yeah, like, do you see people from the platform who are like, all right, I'm out of here. Where did so-and-so go? Oh, he's in Canada now. Or she's in Canada now.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there was one post that certainly surprised me that I saw in Blind in the last week. It was this startup called Rippling, and they actually had a job posting that was called the Return to India Program, mm-hmm. where if you are, you know, an Indian national and you're here in the U.S., working for somewhere else or working internally at Rippling, they're building out a development center in India, and you can go there and kind of be the, basically the leaders or the heads of that department or your function or your business unit in India, literally like returning folks back to land in these higher roles, these more compensated job functions, which is amazing in terms of what they're able to do in terms of kind of being creative with that talent finding.
Wow. Hey, Jess, Rick, I don't mean to get too heavy with this, but do you think these kind of things where with rippling, with deal, with remote, you know, moving jobs all over, you know, the world, is that like a net negative for US white collar workers where all of a sudden you're not just competing against people in New York City or Chicago against each other, now you're competing with the whole world?
Yeah, it definitely makes jobs a lot more competitive overall, right? Instead of, you know, to your point, like instead of just implying, like normally, like competing for a job in just like the San Francisco Bay Area or whatever city you live in, now you're competing with thousands of people for a remote job across the globe, right? I think to Rick's point actually brings up valid points that we're seeing actually too. Like one trend is a lot of companies not backfilling roles in the US. So if they have a bunch of attrition in engineering or product or wherever, they will then go and move that entire, or at least part of that team, to a lower cost area like India or Argentina for labor. And that has good tech talent as well. But I think you'll see, we're gonna see a lot more of that from my vantage point. And I think it's a net positive overall for people across these countries, because tech won't just be isolated to Silicon Valley and Seattle and New York. It'll be a global presence, which I think is great overall.
And you're situated in a good spot for that, Jess, because, you know, you have, you know, connections across the world. So it's like, okay, hey, you want it in Canada? Fine. You want it in India? Fine. You want it in wherever, you know, Latin America? Cool. We'll help out.
Yeah, we're lucky to be at have the vantage point of helping a lot of these companies hire remotely for the last 5 years across the globe. An interesting trend actually from that timeline is 4 to 5 years ago, 90% of our hires were in the US, and now it's less than half, right?
Wow.
It keeps trending down. So that's a huge shift overall with tech hiring.
Rick, Jess, do you think it makes sense for people who are watching this now or in the replay that they have to look forward to saying, maybe I have to get comfortable with the fact that I might need to relocate, not just to a different city or state, but now to a different country, just to be relevant and to have a job and to move forward with my career? Is that you think that's something that's, because the way you guys are talking about, that seems where the future is going. Is that, do you think that's what people have to be prepared for?
Yeah, I'm not so sure, because I think the way that a lot of these companies are seeing kind of foreign workers or foreign offices are more of a compliment rather than a zero-sum game, right? Where a lot of these companies are saying, okay, great, we are US-based. Our head office, our headquarters are in the US. That's where most of our folks are. And so we're still going to have these engineers. We're still going to have these product managers. We're going to still have these strategy folks in the US. But maybe they're going to be creating the roadmap. They're going to be kind of doing that heavy lifting up front. And the beauty with time zones is, you know, let's say that you're doing all of this work in the US day. And at night, when your US team is logging off, you have the folks on the other side of the planet that are logging back on and picking up that work, right? And so from a company's perspective, to kind of work in this globalized workforce, you really get a benefit from just kind of quote unquote being on 24/7, right? And having your team always churning out work. You know, if they have any questions, there's coverage, right? On the other side of the world, in terms of time zone, in terms of skill set, in terms of function area. And so you're really able to kind of do higher level work, right? It's almost I compare it with the concern about AI and these large language models and whether they'll kill all of these jobs. I mean, they're certainly going to take away some jobs, but the new jobs that they create for the existing roles, the higher level work that they unlock, I think certainly outweigh these kind of short-term, you know, consequences, I suppose.
Speaking of AI, so Jesse, you mentioned before that that's kind of one of the hot sectors what type of roles, if someone wants to get into AI, like what kind of background do they need? How hard is it to get into it? If like you have, can you take coursework? What do you think? Is it going to be too saturated too soon because it got just so hot?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's a big trend towards a lot of courses and content and ways to basically like continue your education in the space. And there's a lot of ways to get into like data science more broadly. It can intersect or overlap with AI quite a bit. In fact, like it's a lot of folks would think that you need like a PhD in like computer science to get into AI or AI research. That's not necessarily the case. Like there's a lot of great data scientists that come into the space that have like econ degrees, right? Or some other like mathematical based background. And I think there's a lot of overlap there. So I think I would definitely recommend though, don't do it unless you're passionate about the space, because who knows, this is hot for now. The segment could, you know, could shift back to, you know, crypto the last few years was hot. And then, you know, there's all sorts of like shifts in the industry, like what's popular. So definitely a skill set I think worth knowing and like getting into, but I definitely recommend folks be passionate about it if they're going to do it. It's a big commitment to learn a lot of that stuff, but I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for folks that can show a consistent track record there. So like, even if you don't have background in AI per se, but you're, there's ways to contribute to communities or create content as you're learning, right? And like showing that you have not only like the ability to learn a new sector, but also going out and creating content and sharing that more broadly, right? Like you're passionate about it. And I think that'd be a huge differentiator in interviewing. Doesn't guarantee success, right? There's a lot of steps that go into an interview process, from just applying, networking, and going through all of the process. But I think that's a big component too. And if I'm a hiring manager, looking at your resume and background, like what's the continuous ongoing like learning and creation of like content.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, Jesse, I think I really appreciate your expertise here. You know, we've been able to get really in the weeds in terms of US hiring versus abroad, sector by sector hiring trends. But I want to take a step back and kind of introduce the audience into why we're speaking and why you have this expertise and how you've been able to amass it in such a short amount of time. You know, you're an entrepreneur, you're a founder and CEO of a recruitment processing outsourcing firm. Can you explain what recruitment process outsourcing is for the audience? Why our audience might actually be more familiar than, you know, they might think, even if they've never heard of the acronym RPO before?
Yeah, it's a great question. So recruitment process outsourcing simply is a company that's growing a lot, needs additional resourcing and can't support it internally. And so we'll take over a project-based hiring. Maybe it's hiring like 100 engineers in a short time frame, right? We'll actually execute all of the kickoffs, like operations, scheduling, sourcing, recruiting, closing those candidates. Or it could just be as simple as plugging in individual recruiters into a company to support their internal teams through a growth sprint. I think the difference between using an RPO company and just hiring contractors, generally speaking, is we'll stand behind our service 100%. So what that means is if we don't hit certain KPIs or deliverables, we're going to either spend more money to make it happen or, you know, find a way to make it right to the customer. Whereas like an independent contractor is not going to do that if they don't hire anyone in 6 months. So, so overall, it's a great outcome for like businesses, and we're seeing a huge uptrend there, especially as a lot of tech companies laid off, unfortunately, a lot of their recruiting teams, RPO and like contract or contingent labor is like ramping back up pretty heavily. And I think that'll be an ongoing trend, at least for the next couple of years as companies start to hire again. So,
I mean, so as this trend for these larger and larger companies, or more and more of these companies choosing to do RPO to make up for kind of their own recruitment staff, is there a difference in terms of the candidate experience or the ability for professionals to land jobs at these companies you know, there's some debate in the community on blind, whether it's more advantageous to work with an in-house recruiter versus someone that's at a recruiting agency. I mean, is there a benefit or a different experience if you work with someone that happens to be staffed from an RPO?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. So our recruiter is basically in Bend. They're 100% dedicated to one customer, which is less traditional for most RPO companies, but that's our model. So we only work one-to-one recruiter to the business. They'll basically operate as an internal recruiter in the sense that they'll have that company's email, they'll have that company's LinkedIn logo on LinkedIn. And so from a candidate's perspective, it'll look relatively the same and feel the same. And we'll also do like pitch practice. So it's going to feel, it should feel the same as in the internal process. So I would be surprised if candidates could actually pick out that's an RPO recruiter versus an internal recruiter in most situations. In fact, if you looked at our LinkedIn profile, you see like we have like 55 employees, but that's not actually true. We have like closer to 250 across all companies, but most of them don't even put they're at our company. They're just saying, hey, I'm at Chipotle, I'm at Robin Hood or wherever they're at for our customer base. And you wouldn't even know that they work here. So you have no indication.
Wow. So for a candidate, they apply to a role, you know, they're applying to, let's say, you know, 23andMe or Robin Hood, the person that they're talking to might be working at JobMobs, but you're getting the email from at 23andme.com
yep.
email address.
It's the internal recruiter. Yeah.
They just have like the same tap on the shoulder to the hiring manager to figure out where you are in the process and to move you along. That there's really no difference there.
Yeah. One actual benefit I will say that this is obviously dependent on the account, but like generally speaking, it's an advantage to talk to our RPO recruiters because let's say you talk to one of our recruiters, let's say Jane, and she's at XYZ company, and they just closed that rollout, right? Nothing to do with the candidate. And there's no like future plans to open. Jane could interview to one of our team members, like, hey, work for this role like for a bit, but like talk to John and Jim and everyone else on our team that are hiring for these roles. So you can get introduced to dozens of other companies thereafter. And just to be clear, we do not share candidates across segments. This is only to benefit candidates and companies if the role is closed permanently, right? And so that's a huge advantage for those companies and candidates to get additional resource flow. Wow. So it's actually more like if you talk to an internal recruiter, they're going to have nothing else for you most likely, right? But with an RPO company, we might, like if those roles just closed out, or something to that effect, I would almost guarantee we have another company hiring for the same role.
Interesting. So that advantage is like, oh, wow, you know, if you work with a typical in-house recruiter, once the role is done, I mean, they're moving on to the next role.
Yeah, they have no use for, the candidate, unfortunately. Like, as terrible as that sounds, there's no incentive for them. But for us, we can help out a team member, help out another customer. That's a win-win. And that works as an incentive for like all candidates as well as the customers get an added benefit as well.
Right. And when you say customers, you mean the companies that hire the recruiting outsourcing?
Yeah, they're paying for the support. Yeah, our clients. Yeah.
Got it. That's
correct. Yeah, and it's interesting. Tell me if this makes sense, Jesse. Put aside JobMobs, but just call it widget RPO. It seems there's a benefit, I think, in part, is that you're not involved with all the internal politics that goes on. So if you're an internal talent acquisition person, you know, you always have that tug of war with the HR person, with the hiring manager, with the boss, you know, you have all these things. It's like a family, you know, you have all those like squabbles and stuff. But if you're kind of that hired gun who comes in because they have to fill 10 slots of XYZ, you're not involved with all that stuff. You're just hyper-focused. I got to do my job. And that's a big benefit. Also, to me, from the outside, because I've never worked at it as an RPO, as a third party recruiter, it's also, I think, kind of like you're a management consultant, because if you're working at Robinhood one day, and then you're working at, you know, Google next month, and then you're working at Meta a third month and so forth, you get a good you know, zeitgeist feeling of how each one does things. And then you can incorporate that into figuring out compensation, what they look for, what the competition is doing. So I find that, you know, helpful. The other side, tell me if this makes sense, Jesse, again, not your company, just generally. Sometimes it's harder because the person doesn't know the politics behind the schemes that's going on. So then they're at a little bit of disadvantage because they don't know how much should I push to get this person more money, how much, you know. So it's an interesting different concept. And this is why I was really interested in having this conversation, because I think a lot of people get so confused with recruiters. And that's why recruiters get a bad rap, because they don't know there's like executive search that's retained. There's contingency where you only get paid if you get the placement. You have staffing, you have RPOs. So then if they don't know who they're dealing with, they can get really frustrated and just get ticked off. And you probably see that in blind all the time. They get angry, but they don't know why they're angry because they don't know the relationship of that recruiter they're dealing with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. To your first point, like that's one of the advantages, I think, not only for the recruiter, like you can get come to any RPO and you can have like a breadth of experience across like 3 years of anywhere from 3 to 6 customers, right? And so you're getting a lot of like, as opposed to being like having a jumpy job history where you're jumping from consulting gig to consulting gig. So, hey, I was at this RPO company for 3 years and I worked at XYZ companies, right? A list. So like really great to gain experience. Also like just learning from all of our other recruiters, right? So like our recruiters are across 150 plus different customers. You can learn from all of those folks how they're doing it and get information and feedback and like benchmarking across all of that data. So that's pretty cool. I think in terms of avoiding, that's one of the nice things with being external is that there's no the politics are relatively minimal from our lens, right? We don't have to be involved in any of that internal dynamics. We basically, even if we do all the work, make all the hires, we don't care who gets credit. At the end of the day, we're still getting paid for what we've signed up for, and we're happy that we filled those seats. We don't care. Like that's our goal, in fact, is like to help make those leaders look really, really good. So they can get credit. It's like, hey, we brought in this recruiting firm, they kicked butt. And the upper management probably doesn't know the difference to your point, Jack, between RPO and contingent firm. So they're just like, oh yeah, we brought in this firm and they did it all like 1/3 cheaper than our normal contingent labor workforce. And that's like, so that's
if you don't mind to get a little inside baseball. So if I understand it correctly too, that firms like yourself, you would bid on that contract, right? And then you would have a certain amount. So that, well, let's say from a recruiter like myself, you might have a 25%, 30% placement fee if you place somebody like a, mid to senior level person, where if you're in an RPO, you would probably bid to get that business and set kind of a set price. Is that a little inside baseball stuff? Like, is that how that works?
Happy to share. So yeah, our model is a bit more, direct in terms of like some usually a flat monthly cost depending on like resourcing project scope. Sometimes there's success fees, depends on the customer and what they're looking to do, and length of project and everything else. But just to give some like generalities, it's usually 1/3 to 1/4 the cost of contingent labor, like or even retained labor, in terms of working with like recruiting firms. So your cost per hire is probably sub 10,000 in terms of technical hiring, which is really, really cheap, depending on how you measure it, of course. And for like some of the more like G&A and general administrative type roles, by closer to like sub 5,000. So point being is it saves a lot of money. It's much more economical than even in-house recruiting, which you can add up at like all the different costs. It ends up being much more effective because you can ramp up and off, like ramp on and off. So for example, if you're Coinbase and you need to scale and like hire 1,000 people, you can ramp up for 6 months plus and then scale to 0 recruiters. And that basically allows them to save quite a bit of money. You can't do that in-house. If you hire, 50 recruiters, ramp up in 6 months, then ramp to 0, like a lot of people are gonna be upset. On blind commenting about it. So it's probably a better way of doing things. In fact, a lot of our recruiters, weren't impacted during layoffs, whereas I think like across tech industry, I mean, recruiting layoffs are probably like, unemployment rate is probably like about 40%, some huge number.
It's crushed.
I don't have data on it, but like it's huge. It's like at least, you know, at least one in three recruiters.
Jesse, what do you think about this? If let's say you're a recruiter, you're going to get 20-25%, and you know you're looking at a fee that could be $20,000 to $50,000 to $70,000 to $100,000. So when somebody on Blind is looking, and you get a recruiter who's really pushy, they're pushy because they have a lot of money at stake. Whereas opposed to Jesse's model, you don't have that big amount of money, so like you're not going to be that aggressive in your face, nagging, pushing. Does that make sense? Right. So it's like there's a huge difference. So like when people say like, oh my God, this recruiter won't leave me alone, they keep nagging me. Well, because that recruiter is going to get a huge fee. So they're going to do everything they can. Whereas if it's like a flat cap kind of thing for an RPO, you're not going to go, you're not going to be as like aggressive and annoying.
Does that make sense? Yeah, we have aligned incentives, right, with our customers and with candidate experience overall, right? Like we want what's best for them. Like on both sides of the coin, like we prefer not to hire somebody if we think it's not the right fit for a customer. Whereas like if you're a contingency, you would never say that. RPO, like it's, you know, we're fine giving our 2 cents, right? And so, yeah, it's definitely aligned incentive to, yeah, there's no need to be pushy, in general. So just not a good way to have a good candidate experience. I think it's also like, why a lot of recruiters get bad reputations is for that very reason, right? It's like the misaligned incentives, right? Mm-hmm. You're basically incentivizing behavior that wouldn't normally be acceptable working in-house, so.
But to be clear, I mean, from a candidate perspective, these compensation, like they're not paying, right? So it's the company that's paying these outside folks, but it might be in your advantage to Jack's point to work with that agency recruiter because they're going to go to bat for you, right? So you can kind of take advantage of that from the candidate perspective.
This was good. So like you could see all the sides of it, right? And that's what hopefully the audience gets it. So like they understand, this is why it's happening. Now I get why they're acting the way they do.
Yeah, I think one thing I could like advise to like candidates if I was looking is you just ask the recruiter what the relationship is, right? Like, are you working on like the way that you could frame it is, are you working a retained contract, which means they've already gotten some of the money up front and they get some when they close? Are they working contingent, which is going to be they get all the money or no money when they make a hire or not? And then maybe they're in-house, maybe they're a contract recruiter. That gives you a lot of insight too, because what you don't often know too is even if they're in-house and they're a contract recruiter, their contract might be ending next week. And that's really important detail to know if you're a candidate because they won't tell you that, but you'll just get an email and it'll bounce or forward to someone else. But if you ask them and they told you, say, oh, great, who can, like, if I'm going to move forward, who's my POC? Can you give me their email? Then you preemptively already set. And that happened a lot recently where like recruiters didn't have a backup or candidates didn't have a backup point of contact. Recruiter gets laid off and now you're just kind of in the dark, even though they're still hiring that role. Like that didn't change, right? Like security engineers, any type of engineering roles, product roles, go to market, they're probably still hiring, but the recruiting team's now decimated. And so good to always ask who's like a backup POC that's doing coordination or on HR, so, or hiring manager.
Nice. Brilliant. Thanks for giving us such a kind of an insider's look into what incentivizes recruiters, how recruitment process outsourcing works, and kind of the very high level of what to expect in terms of the job market and layoffs and these hiring freezes and really what professionals can use now to level up their careers. Thanks for coming on the show, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jesse.
Appreciate it.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.